Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Everybody who wants to own a home has got a shot at doing so. The problem is we have what we call a home ownership gap in America. Three quarters of Anglos own their homes, and yet less than 50% of African Americans and Hispanic own homes. That ownership gap signals that something might be wrong in the land of plenty. And we need to do something about it. We are here in Washington, D.C. to address problems. So I've set this goal for the country. We want 5.5 million more homeowners by 2010. Million more minority homeowners by 2010.
Dip, 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 boom, 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 get a job. Now, we have presented before the American people here on the Savage Nation something unique to the media. While that network called Fox was talking about John McCain's body posture today and avoiding, like the plague, a discussion of indicting and arresting the board members of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac because of the corporate interlocking directorships I've told you about over the last few weeks, my staff went and dug up President Bush's speech from June of 2002, where he forced the banks to grant loans to people who are unqualified for a mortgage. You may not understand what is going on with the collapse of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac. I do. And what happened here was the government forced banks to make loans to people who could not qualify for these loans on the basis of racism. And so, as Bush said, he insisted that there were too many white people owning homes in 2002. Just think of his phrase, three-quarters of Anglos own their own homes. Are you an Anglo? I mean, I don't consider myself an Anglo. Where'd the word Anglo come from? That is a derogatory term applied to Caucasians by folks who are not of European descent, by the way. So that's to give you some idea of what we've been dealing with in the White House here. But let's go past his naked racism when he says three-quarters of Anglos own their homes and you're less than 50% of African-Americans and Hispanics own homes. Remember what I'm saying to you. This is a speech from June of 2002 where Bush is saying there are barriers to home ownership and he's going to fix it. And he says he wants 5.5 million more homeowners by 2010 and a million more minority homeowners by 2010. Well, here we are in 2008. The homeowner market has collapsed. The banks are collapsing. The government is bailing out their friends on Wall Street because the government is Wall Street. It's a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. Make no mistake about it. We have no constitution except the constitution of Goldman and Sachs. Whatever Goldman wants, Goldman gets. Whatever Sachs wants, Sachs gets. I mean, I could write a song called Whatever Goldman Wants, Goldman Gets. Whatever Sachs he wants, Sachs he gets. But this is not a laughing matter. This is a very serious matter. What we have on our hands here is the greatest fraud in the history of the American nation. This is the greatest fraud in American history. What many of you don't know is that this bailout is the biggest in financial history. It is taking place right before your eyes. A major league Wall Streeter says that the government takeover of these banks has made the U.S. more communist than China, and yet the media is virtually silent about it. I could not believe, as I sat down to lunch, I turned on Fox, I turned on Neil Cavuto, who normally is a middle-of-the-road kind of guy, And this guy was talking to a girl about John McCain's body language and hugging Sarah Palin. Listen to this in clip 22.
Read into me how this whole thing has evolved. And I want to go back to the first appearance they had together, right, where mm-hmm. it kind of seemed a little tense. Read into it for me.
All right. Well, what would you expect from a little man like him other than this kind of thing? He's a stooge of News Corporation. And the puppets who work for the media barons, who are the equivalent of the robber barons of yesteryear, the media barons determine what shall and shall not play on their stations. Make no mistake about it. No matter what they say, it is the media barons who determine what the robber barons will do. Or shall I say the media barons of today are the robber barons of yesterday. Now, you know, I gave a speech 10 years ago at the Commonwealth Club of California called Beware the Government Media Complex. Some of you listening to this program probably were there. Not many of you could have been there, but some of you may have been there. It said, Beware the Government Media Complex, okay? 1998. Now, here we are in the year 2008. I warned you 10 years ago about the government media complex. I told you then that never before in American history had there been a so cozy relationship between government and the media. I told you that the commercial interests of the media moguls were intertwined with government policy so as to have created an overly friendly image of governmental officials. And I told you that each and every issue as reflected in the old line news media, the TV network news and the establishment newspapers and magazines, was a parallel reflection of official government policy. Now, what we have today is even worse, and I'm going to talk about that today. We are not hearing much about the bailout of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The media has been told to be silent about it. Today, it's back to covering the stump speeches. It's back to whether McCain is too angry and how popular Palin's eyeglasses are and how much time Obama spent at the gym. It's back to the insane media kabuki theater that pushes personality over policy. And in the meanwhile, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, and his Wall Street cronies are laughing inside the bank vault. Now, if you need another example of the power of the government media complex, you need look no further than the meaningless political conventions that were staged over the last 2 weeks. Everything was decided in advance. There was no fight over who the nominee would be at these conventions. There was no fight over what the platforms would be at the conventions. I want to remind you folks that in the past, in conventions past, the nominees and platforms were in fact decided at these conventions. For example, at the 1960 Democratic Convention, John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson actually had a debate before the Texas and Massachusetts delegations. At the 1860 Democratic Convention, the party split because they couldn't decide what the platform would say about slavery. Today, the only decision made at political conventions is which house of ill repute should be gone to after the keynote speech. So today, the government and the media are closer than they've ever been, and the media more in the hands of foreign interests than they've ever been. And this is why the midstream media won't tell you about the biggest fraud in American history. Phone number is 1-800-449-8255. I'm talking about a shocking story, which is the doubling of the national debt over the weekend. And if you trace it back, it goes back to Bush's forcing the banks to grant loans to people who were not qualified for a mortgage. I found the speeches. Listen to now clip 5 from 2002.
First talk about how to make sure America is secure from a group of killers, people who hate. You know what they hate? They hate the idea that somebody can go buy a home. They hate freedom.
Okay, now let's stop there. So he jumps from they hate that you can buy a home. Then he launches into everyone has got to be able to buy a home. And he repeats that there are too many Anglos owning homes proportionate to African Americans and Hispanics. And he concludes that he says we want 5.5 million more homeowners by 2010. And a million more minority homeowners by 2010. Now, I want you to listen to clip 7. This is the most telling.
And so what are the barriers that we can deal with here in Washington? Well, probably the single barrier to first-time homeownership is high down payments. People take a look at the down payment. They say, that's too high. I'm not buying.
Let's stop
second
here.
Barrier is
so George Bush has said that what has sustained sanity in the real estate world for 50 or 60 years was no good. I, for example, wanted to buy a home when I was 25. I couldn't afford one. I wanted to buy a home when I got married at 28. I couldn't afford one. I wanted to buy a home when I had my first child. I couldn't afford one. I had to save every dime I had. And I couldn't buy my first home until I was 35 years old or something like that. I had to save every penny for my entire life. It was something on the order of $6,000 or $7,000, $9,000. I don't really remember what the number was. I was buying a $45,000 house. Yeah, I had to put down $9,000. I said to the banker at one point, I had $6,000. He said, you can't have the house. We cannot lend you money. We cannot give you a mortgage, young man, unless you have 20% down. And I said, why? That's not fair. He said, well, we don't set the rules. We follow the rules. And these rules are actually good, he said, because it prevents people from buying something they can't afford. And as a result, there is less likelihood that they will lose the house after a number of years. Well, I grumbled and walked away, and I said, you know what? I don't like this rule. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to save more money, and I'm going to buy a house. And I did. Of course, I never lost my home because I had to put down 20%. Payments were high, but I did what I could do, and I made sure I made my payments on time. I didn't expect the government to make the payments. But now listen to what George Bush just said, and this goes back to 2002. He is the cause of the collapse of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac. At least his policies are. Now, I understand he didn't set these policies. He was fronting for the interest that wanted more loans to more people for a greater Ponzi scheme in the real estate market. And as a result, housing went up along America. I don't have to tell you what's going on. Everyone listening to this show who had a house probably bought another one, probably invested in one, flipped the house, made some money. And now at the end of the Ponzi scheme, you're all screaming that you got stuck holding the bill. But the fact of the matter is it was all funny money. It was all monopoly money. It was based on nothing. So again, go back to what Bush just said. Play out clip 7.
And so what are the barriers that we can deal with here in Washington? Well, probably the single barrier to first-time home ownership is high down payments. People look, take a look at the down payment. They say, that's too high. I'm not buying. Second barrier is ownership is the lack of affordable housing. There are neighborhoods in America where you just can't find a house that's affordable to purchase. Third problem is the fact that the rules are too complex. People get discouraged by the fine print on the contracts. They take a look and say, well, I'm not so sure I want to sign this. There's too many words.
Yep, there are too many words for you, for sure. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Gap in America. 75% of Anglos own their homes, and yet less than 50% of African Americans and Hispanic own homes. That ownership gap signals that something might be wrong in the land of plenty. And we need to do something about it. We are here in Washington, D.C. to address problems. So I've set this goal for the country. We want 5.5 million more homeowners by 2010. Million more minority homeowners by 2010.
All right, that's President Bush from June of 02, 2002, talking at HUD, saying more minorities needed mortgages. And I believe, and I'm presenting a case, that this policy is the principal policy that has led to the collapse of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac. I don't see the discussion going in the direction of what caused this. And any doctor will tell you that in order to cure a disease, you first have to know what caused it. At least you need to try. Otherwise, you're just treating symptoms. All of new medicine, all of modern medicine is about treating the disease, the causation of the disease, rather than symptoms. All that is wrong with modern medicine that treats symptoms, not causes. Anyone who's been in alternative medicine understands that as you try to get to the core of the illness. In other words, if a person has occluded arteries, the first thing you advise them is a change in lifestyle. You don't just give them statins and tell them, take the statins and keep eating like a pig. Go have the corned beef. Go ahead. Eat your French fries. Eat your ice cream. Go ahead. Eat your milk. Go ahead. Take the pills. That's stupid doctoring. What doctor would say that? Unfortunately, too many do. Now, so we have to get to the root cause of the collapse of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac. And one of the root causes, if not the chief one, not entirely, one of them is this policy of making sure that people qualified for houses who were unqualified. Jerry in New York City on WOR, go ahead, please.
Yeah, Mike, you really went over the top as an African-American. I mean, you even just contradicted yourself with your premise. You quoted Bush saying that he wanted to have a million more minority homeowners, black, Hispanic, but yet he wanted a total of, I think it was 10 million. So that means blacks and Hispanics were the only represented 10%. So isn't then the 90% who are white people on data cause and black people are...
Whoa. We're not talking about cause. We're talking about Bush's policies of giving houses, giving mortgages to people who didn't qualify as a causation for the collapse of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac. I think you're missing the point because you're too focused on your race.
No, you focused race. The speculation.
No, you are a racist man who sees everything in racist terms. I'm playing the president's speech from 02, and I'm showing you that the man had a bad policy. And all you can see in it is something about minorities. You're a blind man. You're a blind man who sees the world through race, and that's a disaster and a tragedy. And I can't have a conversation with a blind man. Don't you understand what I'm saying to you? He made the banks give loans to people who couldn't qualify. How many different ways do I have to say the same thing?
First of all, as president, he can't make a banker give somebody a loan who doesn't have proof of income.
Of course he can't make them, but he was giving the speech at HUD where he said, we want this done. We want this done. So they pressured the banks to grant loans to people, blacks and whites and Hispanics. By the way, many of the Hispanics were illegal aliens. I don't think you understand that. And the collapse now is a direct result of people who can't pay their mortgages. I mean, why do you think people are walking away from their houses, Jerry? Let's put aside race. Let's say it's a white guy in a suburb in Southern California. Why did they lose their house? They couldn't make payments, correct?
Because they had balloon mortgages and they're upside down in the house because the people who were speculators put the market up so high that people were buying $400,000.
Whoa, what do you mean put the market up so high? They bought the house, though. No one forced them to buy the house.
But the houses were overpriced. Can I give you an example?
Oh, they're overpriced according to Jerry in New York. Should they go to you and ask you what the price should be for a house? The market determines the price. Nobody forced that man to buy the house. He took a chance and he lost. Now you and I have to pay for it. Stop seeing this through the eyes of race.
Savage.
All right, so this is a little too dry for most listeners. You'd rather have me talk about the dog urinating in the kitchen or me eating an Italian meal or my hangover. But I am so worked up over the Freddie Mae bailout. I'm so worked up over the fact that the government media complex is not really explaining to you what this means, that we have, in essence, a socialist government in George Bush. I've warned you for several years as I saw it emerging that George Bush was not a fiscal conservative, but a fiscal socialist. I've said that to you. Our debt burden is so high right now, there's no way out of this quandary. I don't understand how the currency will not collapse. I can't understand it. I can't see any way out of this mess. The man writes checks to Africa for $48 billion. Last week, he wrote a check for $1 billion to the country of Georgia. It's funny money. It's monopoly money. It's bankruptcy. In fact, there are people who have written articles that I'm going to get to today that claim we already are bankrupt. There's a great article we put up by Patrick Wood from the World Research Library called The Globalist Ultimatum, Pay Up or Collapse. And he is saying that the net effect of the new international economic order, I'm going to repeat that again. This is for the people who listen to the show who are advanced. The net effect of the new international economic order, it's a term coined by the Trilateral Commission in 1973, was to devise new and more effective ways to divert money from the public sector into certain private hands. He then says that the magnitude of this bailout is on an order higher than anything ever recorded in our planetary history. Of course, everyone in the financial elite are feigning shock and dismay at the tragic turn of events. Saving these companies, they say, will supposedly save our financial system from utter destruction. It's an ultimatum, pay up or collapse. He says, is it all a smokescreen for yet another planned plundering of our treasury? And he goes on and says that this is a plundering of our treasury. And it is being done by none other than Hank Paulson of Goldman Sachs. along with Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, who he says are plundering our Treasury for private gain for the interests that they represent. And I would suggest that you read the whole article. He concludes by saying we can also expect that those who are getting protection for their investments are the global banks and investment houses, not the American people. U.S. citizens are getting hosed while banks, brokerages, hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds, wealthy investors are saved from trillions of dollars in well-deserved losses. By assuming the debts of Fannie and Freddie, the national debt virtually doubles overnight. He says the process should include the investigation of the senior management of these companies for malfeasance and cooking the books to cover it up. Let the free market provide new lenders who perhaps won't be so greedy and ill-principled. Allowing Bernanke and Paulson to administrate our financial crisis is like giving an axe and frying pan to the foxes who were left in charge of the henhouse. Have you heard any calls yet for an investigation of the senior management for malfeasance and cooking the books? Have you heard it from Biden? No. Now we'll go to the other side of the aisle who say, well, okay, the Republicans are crooks. They're for big business. All right. Now let's look at the other side of the aisle. Joe Biden. Notice he's been silent during this discussion of Freddie and Fannie. On my website, michaelsavage.com, there's an article linked from AmLaw Daily, the American Law Daily. And the article is called The Legal Ties That Bind the Bidens. Did you know that Biden has two sons? Did you know that older son, Beau, age 39, is currently the Attorney General of Delaware, and I think he's on the way to Iraq? The younger son, Hunter Biden, is a partner at Oldaker Biden and Bel Air, a Washington law and lobbying firm. Did you know any of this? Did you know that the senator has longstanding relationships with law firms that donated to his congressional races and his two bids for the White House? Are you aware that many of these law firms have handled asbestos and bankruptcy cases, issues that Joe Biden has weighed in on from his seat on the Judicial Committee? Did you know that in 2005 there was an attempt to trim returns on future litigation of asbestos cases, and that would have hurt firms like Simmons Cooper, a billion-dollar asbestos practice which used his son Beau's former law firm, Vifarato, Gentilotti, Biden, and Bailick, as local counsel to file asbestos suits in Delaware? You didn't know any of this. So if you think you're going to get any salvation from the Democrats, you got another guess coming, because you're wrong. And the reason Congress is doing nothing is because they're not representing the people. Congress represents only special interests. That's what this election is all about. It's which party represents fewer special interests, or which party represents special interests that are closer to the people than the other party's special interests. Because make no mistake about it, neither party represents the people. San Francisco, KNEW. Dan, go ahead, please.
When I heard that clip you played of the president at the top of the hour, I thought it was laughable. I am Hispanic. I do not own a home, but I have friends that do, and they're in that same spot where they're going to lose their home. And I knew better than to get involved with investing in any property, because if the government says they're going to help you, you should steer far away.
Well, I don't know about that. All I know is that I had to pay 20% down, and that was the rule up until I think Bush came into power. And did your friends buy the houses with nothing down?
They bought it with less than 20%, and like that last caller said, they do have a balloon payment, which they can't come up with.
Mm-hmm. I understand that, but how much did they put down, though? Do you have any idea? Was it 0, 5, 10%? What would you have any idea? Because I don't know what they were asked for.
Between 5 and 10, I would think.
5 and 10. So they already got an advance on their house in a lower down payment. So let's say they bought a house that was, I'm giving a price, $200,000. That's very below what a house is cost in the Bay Area. They had to put down $40,000 if it was 20%. So they were asked to put down 10%, which is $20,000. So they were given a $20,000 cash advance in advance. How many of your friends went and refinanced their houses along the way with all these shysters in the refinance business who told them to take money out of the equity of the houses that went up to go on vacations and go and gamble and go buy drugs? Did many of them do that, keep refinancing their houses on the assumption that the value would keep going up? I'm sure many of them did.
No, they couldn't. The bank said no because the value had already started to go down at this point.
Oh, so it was fairly recent. I hear you. Thanks for the call. Yeah, has anyone talked about the shysters in the refinance business? That they'll give you money based on the equity of your house? How about those shysters? How have they done in this marketplace? How have the shysters who took these ads for the last, if as long as I can remember, the shysters were on television telling you, take the money out of your house. Get a payment today. Go on that vacation. Go buy your wife some baubles and bangles. Buy your daughter a new car. Take it out of the house. Take the equity out of the house. Go ahead. That's called usury, you idiot. Our whole system is rotten because of the overplay of usury. Do you understand what the word usury means? I don't think you even understand what this means. Usury is interest. Extremely high interest is usury. Now, if you actually analyze the laws of Islam, which are based upon, in many parts, in many ways, Islam is based upon the Old Testament. Make no mistake about it. It wasn't a religion born out of its own. It is derived almost entirely from the Old Testament. No matter what anyone says, all you're going to do is read the two books, and you'll see overlapping similarities. The Old Testament prohibits usury, and many Muslims do not practice usury. I think that's a good idea, don't you? Chicago, Randy, you're on the Savage Nation. No, Randy? Randy, are you there? Go ahead, please. Not there. All right. Next case. 1-800-449-8255, phone number. Chicago, Fred, you're up on the Savage Nation. Topic, please.
Yeah, how you doing? I'm one liberal that's not ashamed to say I agree with you 100% on this. I mean, we've lost our government to these robber barons, and the greatest threat to our country is not terrorism. It's these robber barons that are, you know.
Well, that's the whole point, Fred. I don't think you've heard any partisanship in my delivery today. The fact of the matter is I'm talking about government policies that encourage people to get loans who were not qualified for them. I really don't care who delivered those loans, Democrat or Republican. Somebody benefited from this, and those somebodies are the bankers and the hedge funds that I just mentioned.
I agree with you.
Yeah, and you know, you shouldn't have to say, I'm not ashamed to admit as a liberal I agree with you. Why do you have to be ashamed? If a liberal says something I agree with, why do I have to qualify it and say, even though he's a liberal, he's right? It doesn't matter to me what the person's party affiliation is. I had Charles Schumer on this show, a man whose policies are upside down with regard to mine on 99% of the issues. But 2 years ago, when Bush wanted to give away the management of our port security to the folks in Dubai, I knew it was a bad idea for our national security. So I sought out even liberals who agreed with me. You know, politics makes strange bedfellows.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Keep up.
Well, I'm glad you're open-minded enough to listen to what I have to say instead of prejudging me and saying everything Michael Savage says is wrong. I have people listen to me who agree with me and say I still disagree with them because I don't like them.
100% on this.
All right. Well, I'm sure you don't agree with me on anything else, but that's a good start. Now, I'm going to take a deep breath because I'm getting exhausted from all of this. I don't want to blow my entire energy, you know, wad in the first hour here, so to speak. I've got to save my powder and save my lead for the next hour. So let us begin with another topic. Here is an unqualified Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. She is as unqualified, if not more so, than Madeleine Albright. She is as unqualified, if not more so, than the corpses who have been in the State Department ever since Schultz left. But listen to what Rice says. Now that her term is about up, suddenly now she jumps and puts on a different face. Listen to clip one.
I have lamented that I can go into a meeting at the Department of State. As a matter of fact, I can go into a whole day of meetings at the Department of State and actually rarely see somebody who looks like me. Mm. And that's just not acceptable. And so,
well, what do you mean looks like you? I don't get it. Does she want them to clone her? Because she isn't a married woman. Is Condoleezza Rice saying that she should be cloned because she's so wonderful? Well, she made these speeches not at the annual conference of the White House Initiative on Cloning, but it was at the annual conference of the White House Initiative on National Historically Black Colleges and Universities. So I guess she's arguing that we need more people of color in the State Department, and that by simply finding people of color, we would have a better State Department. This is unbelievable to me. This is incomprehensible. Now listen to clip three.
Congressman Charles Rangel and I have been targeting students at schools with large minority populations. I've been working hard to double the number of Rangel fellows, many of whom hail from institutions like yours.
Whoa, double the number of Rangel fellows? Rangel fellows? Whoa, Charlie Rangel has some financial problems right now, Condi. It's something to do with not reporting income on a condominium he owns in the Dominican Republic, Condi, and underreporting income, Condi. Are you sure you want young people of color to receive a Wrangell fellowship to interest them in foreign affairs? I'm not so sure that you want them to do that. Now, the biggest story of the week has been already buried and covered up. And that is George Stephanopoulos covering up for Barack Hussein Obama when he acknowledges that he is a Muslim in clip four. So play it again.
Let's not play games. What I was suggesting, you're absolutely right that John McCain has not talked about my Muslim faith. And you're absolutely right that that has not
Christian
come.
Faith.
Now, you see what happened here? He said my Muslim faith without blinking an eye, matter-of-factly, and Stephanopoulos didn't catch it himself. His earphone gave him a signal. The fat guy in the back with the curly hair and the big eyeglasses who runs the news, the kid from NYU who hears all, sees all, and speaks all, the man who speaks only evil, the man in the back room of ABC News, the kid from NYU, the communist, the Marxist, in the back room buzzed Stephanopoulos and said, say Christian faith. And he said Christian faith in order to cover for Barack Hussein Obama. Now, that's what I mean by the government media complex as well. So both sides of the aisle are covered by them. Now, you may say, well, what's wrong with Barack Hussein Obama being a Muslim? I would say in the face of it, nothing. Then why does he continuously deny that he's a Muslim if by a slip of the tongue he already delivered what everybody knows to be true? The Los Angeles Times published an article that I have up on michaelsavage.com. I said the LA Times, it's as liberal as they get. Flashback. Childhood friends say Obama prayed at mosque. Los Angeles Times on michaelsavage.com. I will read it to you. It's very important. You have to know the article. It was written by Paul Watson, LA Times. It says, as a child, Obama crossed the cultural divide in Indonesia. Now, I know many of you liberals like people who cross cultural divides because you think it makes you a broader person, not a simple-minded Anglo who is bigoted and small-minded. And I understand that's how you see the world. But the fact of the matter is, it says at the local primary school, he prayed in thanks to a Catholic saint in the neighborhood mosque, he bowed to Allah. So he is both a Muslim and a Christian. And although his campaign aides have emphasized his strong Christian beliefs and downplayed any Islamic connection, the fact of the matter is he was raised in a secular household in Indonesia by his stepfather and mother, right? That's what his spokesman Robert Gibbs said in January after reports began circulating that Obama had attended a radical madrasa or Quranic school as a child. That's what he said then. But then the campaign of Obama changed their tune on Wednesday, and they changed, or a slightly different wording was offered. And they said this. They said Obama has never been a practicing Muslim. Practicing Muslim. They then went on and said that as a child, Obama had spent time in the neighborhood's Islamic center. So if you read the whole articles, you'll understand that the sensitivity of Islam as a political issue is something that should not be underestimated in this election. As you know, Obama was born in Honolulu. When he was two, his father, Barack Hussein Obama Sr., a Kenyan, and his Kansas-born mother, Ann Dunham, separated and later divorced. The father fled back to Africa and abandoned the family. The mother later married Lolo Sotoro, who was a Muslim. Okay? In 67, the family moved to Jakarta, where Obama lived from ages 6 to 10. And that is where the man was associated with Islam, because Islam is the principal religion of Indonesia. And you have to understand this, and you have to say, well, what does it have to do with anything? Shouldn't we ignore a person's religion? Oh, sure, we should. All you liberals are so progressive on that issue, yet you wouldn't leave poor Romney alone, would you, when he was a Mormon? You won't leave the religion issue alone when it comes to Christianity, will you? But suddenly you give only one religion a pass, and that's Islam. Why is that, that you liberals are so tolerant of religions other than the one in which you were born? How come you're not tolerant of people of your own faith, but you have tolerance for people of every other faith? Could it be because you're a self-hating liberal? Think about it and get back to me.
Savage.
The book that I know you've all been waiting for. Psychological Nudity is the title. And here we are, 75 stories from Michael's colorful life history are contained in this limited first edition printing. And you can go to michaelsavage.com and you're going to see the picture of me holding Teddy, my dog. The classic stories I've told on the radio were translated for the written word. And I have to say translated for obvious reasons, because the spoken word and the written word are two different mediums. They're not the same. One Arm Frank, Love by the Sewer Plant, Dead Man's Pants, Savage's Childhood Diet, that's a prescription for a heart attack, Tippy the Dog Dies and is Thrown into a Garbage Truck, When Pasta Was Spaghetti, From Immigrant Son to Radio Stardom, and many more favorites are in this book, 75, by the way. Are there political stories? A few. The Medical Reason Why Liberalism is a Mental Disorder, Debunking Man-Induced Global Warming, Republicans Should Treat Voters Like Restaurant Customers, Psychological Nudity. It's a must for everyone who's read a Savage book. It's an original. Kindly go to michaelsavage.com, review the cover, click, and there it is, and I'll know how many you print.
Savage.
Yep. And life goes on, and I sit here every morning, I wake up, and I don't know how it can go on like this. If you have the national debt doubled over a weekend and there's no vote on it, you ask yourself, who's running the country? How could there be a Congress that is so lackluster as the one we have today, where there's not even a hearing on this? Nothing. How could Bush simply say over the weekend, we're nationalizing these two banks? We're going to bail out these two banks. How is this possible? How could it be done with the stroke of a pen unless we live in a dictatorship? If Hugo Chavez had nationalized banks in Venezuela, you'd be hearing a hue and a cry from the entire conservative media that he is a dictator, a left-wing dictator. But when Bush nationalizes the large banks called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, we hear nothing from the minions in the media. Why? Interlocking corporate directorships. It's getting so bad. And it's primarily because many of you don't even understand the context in which Freddie Mae and Fannie Mac were created, and you don't even understand what a socialist government is. George Bush is a fiscal socialist.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Everybody who wants to own a home has got a shot at doing so. The problem is we have what we call a home ownership gap in America. 75% of Anglos own their homes, and yet less than 50% of African Americans and Hispanic own homes. That ownership gap signals that something might be wrong in the land of plenty. And we need to do something about it. We are here in Washington, D.C. to address problems. So I've set this goal for the country. We want 5.5 million more homeowners by 2010. Million more minority homeowners by 2010.
Well, now you understand how the collapse occurred. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. This speech was from President Bush in June of 2002. He gave the speech at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, which is unto itself a socialist division of the United States government that should never have been created. But he went further than HUD has gone ever before. This is well beyond Section 8 housing. This is a speech that on the face of it is troublesome because it's racist. He is saying that three quarters of Anglos own their homes and less than 50% of African Americans and Hispanics own their homes, as if to imply that there was a wink, wink, nod, nod between the hardworking people who qualified for loans and the banker, and that the bankers were somehow racist who would not give loans to African Americans and Hispanics who might qualify otherwise. The fact of the matter is what the speech did was trigger the debacle we are facing today. He wanted 5.5 million more homeowners by 2010. He wanted a million more minority homeowners by 2010 without regard to their immigration status. Well, he's got them. And unfortunately, many people are losing their houses today because they never should have been granted a mortgage to begin with. Mortgages are not a government benefit. A mortgage is a privilege. It's not a benefit. Don't you understand how the free market works? How many times do I have to tell you that not everybody would love a house? The reason we have such a great economic system is because it's based upon competition, not upon a government bailing out its friends and screwing the investors. And that's why people are calling for an investigation. That's why intelligent people are saying that the bailout is on an order higher than anything ever recorded in our planetary history. That is why people are saying that Paulson and Bernanke are appearing together in public on a continual basis. That is why people are saying that the government ought to investigate their senior management for malfeasance and cooking the books who have covered it up. That means the senior management of Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac. That is because U.S. citizens are getting hosed while banks, brokerages, hedge funds, sovereign wealth funds, wealthy investors are saved from the trillions of dollars in well-deserved losses. Did you know that by assuming the debts of these two banks, Fannie and Freddie, George Bush doubled the national debt over the weekend? Did you know that? Did you know that the government risks a downgrade to our existing debt, possibly pushing borrowing costs up by hundreds of billions of dollars per year? I am demanding that Congress let Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac fail like any other grossly mismanaged company as well. I'm also demanding that Congress, whoever that may be, of course, this is a ludicrous statement for me to ask for an investigation of the senior management of Fannie and Freddie, when in fact the lobbyists who put these people onto Fannie and Freddie have also feathered the nests of too many people in Congress. 10 years ago, I made a speech in San Francisco before the Commonwealth Club of California. And in the speech in 1998, I warned you about the government media complex. In this speech, I warned America that never before in American history had there been so cozy a relationship between government and media. In 1998, I was merely a local host on a single station, a great station in San Francisco. I am now heard on over 350 stations across America. It doesn't matter to me that I am reviled by those in the midstream media because they work for the folks who control many corporations. And there are topics they will not touch. That is why Obama appears on Fox. Would Obama come before Michael Savage? Well, the answer is, of course he wouldn't. Why won't John McCain come before Michael Savage? I thought he's a great conservative. I thought he's a maverick. Gee, wouldn't you think the maverick would want to meet the mavericks who listen to this show? He doesn't want the 8 to 10 million votes? No, because he wants to go to places that are safe. He wants to go to places where people will not ask him about his immigration policies. Instead, we have to hear about his maverick policies, which, of course, is nothing but personality as opposed to policy. And that is why the Savage Nation thrives, despite the fact that it is starved of water and sunlight by the media. And I don't really care. All I can tell you is this. The speech of 10 years ago is as fresh today as it was then. When I come back, I'm going to play 2 minutes of it. And you judge for yourself right here on the Savage Nation. Beware the government media complex. Savage. Beware the government media complex. I hope to prove to you over the next period of time that perhaps never before in American history has there been so cozy a relationship. And this, by the way, transcends right or left, has nothing to do with race, has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with press freedom.
And I want to state that from the outset. I believe that today we have a relationship that is too cozy between government and media. Many of the speeches that are given before the Commonwealth Club, many of them, are picked up and rebroadcast by the local NPR radio station. Do you see any NPR people here? No. Many of the speeches given before the Commonwealth Club are transmitted on C-SPAN, which is paid for by the cable companies. Do you see any C-SPAN cameras here? Beware the government media complex. You know, the media, ladies and gentlemen, as you well know, is needed by you and by me, by the public, very badly needed, to be and to remain a thorn in the side of the government. In order to keep the government relatively honest, you need a media that's constantly poking at them. However, when the media instead becomes a thorn in the side of the skeptical private citizen, the media then becomes an arm of the government. Beware the government media complex. When agitators for the homeless riot, when they burn trash cans, they break the law, but they're held up as freedom fighters for the poor by the left-leaning press. But if one compassionate conservative dares to speak out, he's condemned to the gulag of media silence, the gulag of media exile. This startling bias in the media is more threatening to the pillars of our republic than even the most ardent conservative might believe. It is censorship by default as well. What do I mean by censorship by default? Where the commercial interests of the media moguls are so intertwined with government policy as to create an overly friendly image of government officials and their policies. So it may not be as clear as a conspiracy to bias the news, but it comes out to be the same thing anyway. Now, this bias is not limited to the left. It is largely a product of left-wing bias when it comes to certain social issues, such as affirmative action or gay rights. But the right also biases the news when it wants to shade fiscal issues to their benefit. Example, Rupert Murdoch and the China scandal. I first began this file on the government media complex about 3 years ago. I noticed an alarming bias occurring, and I knew that without correction, this could sink the ship of truth. Now, surely other administrations have had their friends in high media places, but still, there were many voices and many views of dissent which found their way into the national media. But now we have a growing media blackout of some serious crimes and misdemeanors, all unsolved to the satisfaction of those with critical powers of reason. Take any major policy issue, and you're going to see the government's official line reflected by the media elite. Let's look at some issues. Affirmative action, immigration, legal and illegal, the drug epidemic. How often do you hear about it? You hear a constant refrain, for example, about the dangers of tobacco. How often do you hear about the crack epidemic, the growing use of marijuana, the heroin epidemic? You hear about it, but all you really hear about is tobacco, tobacco, tobacco. Welfare, the so-called homelessness issue, taxes, each and every issue as reflected in the old line news media, that's TV network news and established newspapers and news magazines, is a parallel reflection of official policy. Listen to this carefully, if you will, and tell me if you agree. Hoover Institution historian Robert Conquest said that in the former Soviet Union, the press was totally under the control of the state. All editors were members of the Communist Party. Here in the United States of America, a frighteningly imbalanced Washington press corps exists. The media is needed by the public to be and to remain a thorn in the side of the government in order to keep the government relatively honest. But when the media instead becomes a thorn in the side of the skeptical private citizen, the media then becomes an arm of the government. Is this not worrisome? Beware the government media complex. In the next few minutes, I want to give you some examples of what I mean. In the 1950s, President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned Americans to beware the military-industrial complex. And this became a rallying cry for anti-military liberals for over three decades. Today, the warning should be very aware of the deeply incestuous relationship between media tycoons, their talking heads, and their federal government counterparts. Which is the tail? Which is the dog? Follow the money. Never before have so few controlled so many image and word outlets. Is it a monopoly? You bet. It grows each day, my file, on this connection. We must ask the question, will the market shape up the media? Ladies and gentlemen, despite competition, the newsrooms are not taking the hints. We have talk radio has evolved, building a huge audience. We have the internet has evolved, attracting a huge audience. The circulation of the newspapers are plummeting across the country. Yet the newsrooms don't seem to be understanding what is going on. Why is that? Well, it could include sloppiness. It could be because of sensationalism. It could be because, though, of political bias. I think it's because of political bias. I think that the old media's bias and the lawyers who control the newsrooms in cahoots with the owners are responsible for this lack of response to the public's outcry. There was an obituary for a journalist in the New York Times. I love reading obituaries. I guess I've reached that age. And I wonder who'll publish my obituary when the time comes. I guess many people in the audience do that after a certain age. And you wonder if you're going to be covered by anybody when you pass on and what people will say about you. Well, this is an interesting obituary. Norman E. Isaacs, age 89, died. His name, I never heard of him. It said, journalist and expert on newspaper issues. I read further, and here was his claim to fame. It said that in 1969 and 70, he was president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and in that role, he charged in a speech that the Nixon administration was seeking to intimidate and muzzle the American press and television. Well, as you well know, because he did that in 69 and 70, he warned America about Nixon's draconian attempts to control the press. He went right up to the stellar heights of the media. And there was a beautiful obituary written for Mr. Isaacs in the New York Times. Beware the government media complex. Now, look, I have a bias. I go on the radio every day and I say I have a somewhat conservative bias, and I'm open about that. Why doesn't the New York Times just say we have a bias, so it comes with a warning label. Beware the government media complex. Stories every day. Here's another story out of the New York Times. The strange case of faked hate crimes. Do you remember for about a year we were told that black churches were burning in the South? That's all the news ran. Black churches were burning in the South. Now, we're all against the burning of churches, whether they're black or white, the burning of mosques or synagogues. There's nothing fundamentally more un-American than burning a house of worship. But the press kept running the story, black churches are burning in the South. Well, about a year and a half after this story appeared and kept reappearing by the mainstream old-line press, the FBI did an intense study of the church burnings. And what they found was many of the burnings were set by their own ministers in order to collect insurance. They also discovered that many of the churches that were burnt were not predominantly black. They were also churches attended by white parishioners. Did you read a follow-up story in the mainstream press which said, sorry, folks, they were not black churches which were burning. There were churches in general, and there was some arson involved? No, because they'd never admit their mistake. Here's another story. Right after TWA Flight 800, investigation of it, the explosion of Flight 800, there was a huge study done by one of the agencies of the government. What witnesses believed to be missiles streaking toward the plane, we were told by the New York Times, were actually the flames and fire trails left by the plane's breakup. That's very interesting. The FBI spent $14 million proving its point. The New York Times said the following: the FBI has been justly criticized in recent years for erratic and often furtive behavior. Now listen to those words. In recent years, the FBI has been criticized for erratic and furtive behavior. Do you call killing 80 innocent people at Waco, Texas, erratic and furtive behavior? I don't, and I won't justify that behavior. And I think that the people who were responsible for it, even if it was an accident, should have gone to jail. I don't care that they're government officials. If I make a mistake at work, I can get fired. If I killed somebody, I would go to jail and possibly get the death sentence. And the same standard should apply to a federal government official who may accidentally kill 80 innocent men, women, and children.
Savage.
Many of you are not focused on this. All you care about is the horse race between McCain and Obama, and all you want to know is McCain going to win or this and that? And I'm telling you that both of these candidates owe us a press conference yesterday telling us what they're going to do to the robber barons who just did this to America when they become president. I haven't heard that yet. I haven't heard either of them say that when they become president, they're going to have immediate hearings. They're going to look into the directorship of Fannie and Freddie, and they're going to get to the bottom of it. And if there was any malfeasance, people are going to go to jail. Their assets are going to be seized. Hey, I would vote for that person immediately. But I don't hear it from Obama, the Robin Hood. Many of you fools think that Obama's an independent and he's a Robin Hood who's going to take from the rich and give to the poor. You're that naive. You think that a man can rise from nothing in America and become a presidential candidate if he's not owned lock, stock, and barrel like all of them. Now, look, I'm an idealist, and I understand that that's a problem. It's a problem. It's been a problem for me all my life. It's been a problem for me all of my life, my idealism. It's gotten me in a lot of trouble. It's cost me jobs. In fact, one of the stories that I tell in psychological nudity is the killing of lab rats in graduate school. I had gone on a small fellowship in pharmacology. That's the study of pharmaceuticals. And one of my duties when I first got there on a $300 a month fellowship was working in a laboratory where they did experiments on animals, with medication. So I knew from nothing. I was a kid, really. The professor says to me, well, the first job you're going to have is to kill lab rats. You put a needle in you hold a little furry creature. You soothe them by touching the back of their heads. And then you put a needle in the back of their brain and you kill them. You pith their skull. I said, I'm not going to do that. And he said, well, if you don't do that, you're going to be thrown out of this department. You're going to lose your fellowship. I said, look, I have nothing else. I said, I'm 5,000 miles from home. It's $300 a month. It's all I've got. He said, I really don't care what you say. He said, you're going to lose your fellowship unless you continue to kill rats, unless you begin killing rats. Now, this story is actually true, as are all the stories in psychological nudity, but let me go on. I'm talking about my idealism today on the radio, my idealism yesterday in graduate school, my idealism as a little boy in the streets, and my idealism has gotten me in trouble then. It's getting me in trouble right now. So let me go back to the lab rat story. I went home and I thought about it, and I said, well, I could start killing these little animals and keep my fellowship because otherwise I'm going to be broke. Or I could say, go to hell to the professor. I lose my fellowship, and I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, as always, when I face things in my life, I went with my best instincts, and I said to him, go to that place where I don't want to go to. You can go to that place where I hope I never have to visit. He said, well, you lost your fellowship. I said, that's the way it is. And then I wandered the halls of the university. I remember this to this day. And I wound up in the basement of the same building, and I saw bottles filled with herbals. Leaves and roots and bark and this and that, and I didn't know what it was. So I went into the friendly professor's office and I said, what are all those things? He said, well, those are called herbal medicines. I said, well, where do they come from? He said, well, they come from the South Pacific in an island chain called Samoa. I said, Samoa? How do you get them here? He said, well, we have a scientist down there who goes to the islands and he sits with the folk healers and he listens to them and he collects the plants and sends them back. I said, what is his name? What kind of science is that? He said, it's called ethnobotany. I said, okay, I'm going to become an ethnobotanist. And because of that decision where I wouldn't kill the lab rats, because I gave up my only income, I found something that led me for the next 15 to 20 years of my life. I became fascinated with herbal medicine. It absorbed every ounce of my being. 99% of my psychic energy was devoted to herbal medicine. I then went on and earned a PhD, two master's degrees and a PhD. I wrote books. I didn't make a fortune off it. I didn't become a rich man, but I followed my dream, and it paid off for me in that regard. I mean, I had a struggle. I didn't get a son at the end. The story doesn't end with, I'm rich because of it. I didn't discover a drug that I then sold to Pfizer that made me $1 billion. I mean, I wish I had, but I didn't. Again, what I'm getting at is sometimes your idealism will cost you money. It'll cost you a job. But if you continue to follow the best instincts in yourself, sometimes if you're lucky, things will work out. Now, that brings us to today. I am complaining about the bailout of Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae. I'm complaining because I'm an idealist and I don't like people robbing the American people. I'm complaining because I don't like robber barons on Wall Street getting away with virtual financial murder. I am complaining because there's a cause for the collapse of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and there's no coverage of it to speak of in the midstream media. I am complaining because I seem to be a man alone in the media today, not only on this, but on so many other topics. I am complaining because so many of the people in my audience are so gullible. They have been gulled by the Republican Party into thinking that they're actually voting for a Republican in John McCain. I am very frustrated by the brainwashing and the propaganda that has been inflicted upon you, the audience, for the last 10 years in talk radio, primarily by frauds who cavort as though they're conservatives, and they won't even touch these topics because if they do, they lose all access to the Republican Party. And the minute they lose access to the Republican Party, their shows are over because they live on guests. And so, therefore, as I say to you, I'm frustrated as an idealist on the Savage Nation today and virtually every day. Every time I speak my mind, I gore somebody's ox. And as you well know, that is not a very wise thing to do. The wise thing to do is to become a politician and to say nothing, to suddenly speak in riddles, to become like all the politicians in America who say nothing. They speak and nothing comes out of their mouths. They speak and they answer no questions. They speak so they do not offend anyone. And as a result, we have the greatest fraud in the history of this republic, a fraud that we may not recover from. And I want to remind you that I just made a statement that could be true, and I pray it is false. The fraud being promulgated right now by the government media complex could be a fatal fraud that destroys this nation. I was reading a book on the history of World War II, the history of the campaign in Italy and Sicily, last night. I'm going to get the book, actually, in a few minutes. It's in another part of the radio studio. I brought it and forgot to bring it in. And in reading it, I was reading about the various generals and lieutenant colonels who were fighting each other, the Nazis versus the Americans and the Canadians and the New Zealanders and the different personalities. And this particular chapter was about the bombing of Monte Cassino in Italy, one of the great tragedies of World War II. Now, you may not know it, but it was off limits to bomb and to destroy any cultural properties in World War II. They tried very hard, and it was official policy both of the Nazis and of the Allies not to destroy cultural properties in Italy. Italy, the richest country on earth with regard to culture, the vast holdings of libraries of books, medieval manuscripts, illustrated manuscripts, paintings that were in these monasteries and churches. Now, of course, many of them were lost forever. But Monte Cassino was in a class by itself. It was on top of a great mountain near Piemonte. And the Allies were on their way to Rome and couldn't get to Rome. They assumed that the Germans were holed up inside the monastery. But in fact, according to this book, there were no Nazis in there. It was a complete lie. It was a lie promulgated by some American generals, mainly Hap Arnold, the head of the U.S. Air Force, who wanted to prove that U.S. air power was necessary in order to make sure that we could create an air force separate from the Army Air Force. And so Hap Arnold was arguing to bomb Monte Cassino so they can go on to Rome. While generals who were far better than him, far more civilized than Hap Arnold, such as Mark Clark, were arguing against bombing Monte Cassino. Mark Clark said, there are no Nazis in there. We've analyzed it from every angle. We've sent spotter planes. We have this. We have that. There's no Nazis in there. They're not shooting at us. They're not even looking at us from there. And he lost, of course. Mark Clark lost. Now, on the other side was a Nazi lieutenant general, whose name I forget. I'll get it for you later, who was from an old German family. He was vehemently anti-Hitler. He was an anti-Nazi. He just happened to be a lifetime military officer. And he did what he had to do, even though he detested Hitler and his Nazi policies. But he was of a descendant. It was a family of military who had to serve his country no matter what. Well, he was a very civilized man. He had been a scholar. But in reading about this Nazi's life, I should say this German general's life, because he was not a Nazi in that sense. In fact, in one case, he was one of the only generals to have stood up to Hitler. Hitler told him to kill all of the German, all of the Italians, all the Italian turncoats who were fighting alongside them, who then fled from the Germans and tried to join the Allies. Hitler had given him instructions to kill every one of them. The German refused to do so. Now, that normally would have meant death to any German who stood up to Hitler like this or defied orders. But because he successfully led a retreat of an entire brigade of German officers safely out of that area, Hitler let him get away with that standing up to him, so to speak. I'm giving you a little taste of who this German was, but I'm getting to another point. It's a long story, but I tend to digress, so forgive me. I go back to my reading, and I'm much happier when I read books than when I watch television, because I grew up as a scholar, and frankly, the way things are going in my life, that's what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, which is read history, because there's nothing else I care to do. Everything else bores me to death. So, to make a long story short, in reading about this German general, this civilized German general, it says the following. He came from an aristocratic German family that had lost all of its fortune, all of its estates in the Napoleonic Wars, and then had lost all of its remaining income during the collapse of the Weimar Republic. And a chill went up my spine. Because many people who listen to this show are people with money. Not all, but many are. And they don't realize that fortunes have been made and fortunes have been lost. Fortunes have come and fortunes have gone. Nations have come and nations have gone. And the United States of America is no different. It is a noble experiment. And I am afraid that after almost 16 years of Clinton and Bush, we are in for a downturn from which we might never recover. I'll be right back. So the news story of the day, keeping it news focused, is the bailout of Freddie and Fannie and the fact that it doubled our national debt overnight over the weekend. And that we may never recover from this scandal and this chicanery and this outright thievery. And yet there's been not a comment on it, so far as I can tell, from any of the esteemed members of Congress, nor from either of the candidates, saying that they'll get to the bottom of it. And they will pursue anyone who may have conducted cooking the books to the full extent of the law and seize their assets if they become president. So then I was telling you, I was reading a book last night called The Day of Battle, The War in Sicily and Italy, 1943-44, by Rick Atkinson. The book is astounding. And I'm reading about it, and there's a character that comes up, a German general I never heard of, called Fridolin von Senger. And von Senger was commanding the 14th Panzer Corps in the 10th Army. And here was a man who detested the National Socialist cause that he was fighting for. It says he bore the burden and the stain of serving a National Socialist cause he despised, and he did it anyway because he was an aristocrat in the military. He had to do what the government wanted him to do. But here's the point to do with economics. Let me read you this sentence. His daughter later claimed that he was descended from an ancient family of lesser princes that lost its estates in the Napoleonic Wars, and its wealth in the Weimar inflation. Now, I did remember that. Shows you my memory is still operating very well. Senger had studied at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar before finding his calling in the Great War. When his younger brother was killed at Cambrai in 1917, Senger dug for hours through a mass grave in no man's land, determined to give him a more dignified interment. Quote, "At last we got the body out, which had lain in the lowest of the three levels," he later wrote. "I took hold of my brother's legs and dragged him thus into my car. On the seat beside me sat my lifeless brother, close quote. There's another piece in here about avoiding bombing Monte Cassino, because Monte Cassino was a great treasure. And as I say, one of our great generals tried to stop it, General Mark Clark, and made a last effort to forestall the attack on Monte Cassino. He said no evidence placed Germans inside the abbey. And then he said previous efforts to bomb a building or a town to prevent its use by the Germans always failed. And then he added it would be shameful to destroy the abbey and its treasure, not to mention any innocent civilians inside. Then he went on and said, if the Germans are not in the monastery now, they certainly will be in the rubble after the bombing ends, Clark said, which, by the way, turned out to be true. So now one last piece about von Senger, the German on the other side, and that is very important for you to hear. Since taking over the casino front, he had scrupulously followed orders to keep his troops away from the abbey, lest they anger the Vatican. When Abbot D'Amate invited Senger, that's the German, to Christmas dinner and mass in the Monte Cassino crypt, he avoided looking out the windows rather than violate the abbey's neutrality by scanning Allied positions below. Did you hear this? Can you believe that the dignity and the honor of the men in that generation in the military on both sides? Some of them had phenomenal honor in the military, and I'm sure many do today. And then Senger said this. He knew the war was lost, and he said, the rotten thing is to keep fighting and fighting and to know all along that we have lost this war, he told his aide. Did you hear that? He knew he was going to lose. But he had a report to a general named Kesselring, and he said Kesselring's cheery attitude baffled him. After 5 months in the Italian mountains, Senger insisted, quote, optimism is the elixir of life for the weak, close quote. Now, how many times have I told you that I don't have to act like an optimist just to satisfy the American tempo of the times? Remember when I once had a whole show and a man saying I should be more optimistic? That's because you listen to too many Carney Barkers in the media. Who says optimism is the natural place, the natural modality for a man's personality? Well, where does it come that optimism, it's like a national thing for America. You have to be an optimist. Well, what if I'm not an optimist? What does it make me, a communist? Optimism is the elixir of life for the weak. I bear the burden of the show. And I serve this show. I do the best I can. And not unlike someone I'm reading about here, I also have read Aquinas and find comfort in the theologian's teaching, where the theologian Aquinas wrote, no man can be held answerable for the misdeeds of those over whom he has no power. And I'll leave it at that. So here's a German general who was not a Nazi, who hated Hitler, who did not want to violate the abbey's neutrality, did not want to bomb did not want to have the Allies bomb Monte Cassino, so he studiously avoided putting troops in there or even scanning Allied positions when he went there for Christmas dinner. He hated Hitler. He hated optimism, the optimism of generals, because he knew the optimism was false, and he called optimism the elixir of life for the weak. And as best he could, he said he sipped wine in his refuge while listening to evening concerts on his service radio or sitting with comrades to again watch his favorite movies, such as The White Dream, about a lovesick Viennese theater manager. He read Aquinas and found cold comfort in the theologian's teaching, quote, no man can be held answerable for the misdeeds of those over whom he has no power. And I rest my case. I cannot be held answerable for the misdeeds of Wall Street. I cannot be held answerable for the misdeeds of the Republican Party. I cannot be held answerable for the misdeeds of those in the media who are misleading you into thinking that all is well, because if only we elect a Republican, America will be great again. I am sorry, my friends, but you know, 6 months ago, John McCain was seen for what he was, a compromised, middle-of-the-road sellout who belonged to neither party, a man who was a turncoat to conservative beliefs, a man who disgraced the name of the man whose seat he took in Arizona, a man who was an embarrassment to the Republican Party to the extent that he almost switched parties and became a Democrat. And now you believe the Carney Barkers when they tell you that if only you elect John McCain, everything will be well. Well, of course, I understand Obama is Karl Marx, too, with a little bit of Islam thrown in, and I certainly would not vote for the man because of the questions about him and the fact that his only experience is of shooting staples into telephone poles in Chicago. And on the issue of national security, sure, I'll go with McCain. At least he fired rockets at our enemies while flying an American war jet. But on all other issues, all bets are off.
Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome back to the program. We're talking about history. We're talking about politics. We're talking about the news. We're talking about anything that makes sense on the Savage Nation. And the bailout of Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae, I don't know why I'm the Lone Ranger here. To me, this is the biggest story of my career in radio. There's no bigger story. And to think that it's coming, the socialization of the banking system, the nationalization, rather, of the banking system, is coming in the midst of a heated campaign. And it's not even being discussed by McCain nor Obama, certainly not by the shills in the media who are letting them get away with it for obvious reasons. But do you understand what just happened, how significant it is? Now, many of you who listen to this show are highly educated. Many of you are very highly educated, and you've come to listen to me. And although I have a truck driver's delivery, although I have the voice of a truck driver, a common man, when you listen to what I actually say, or you just hear my words, or you actually write down the words that I use, you realize that beneath the truck driver, there's an educated, literate human being who understands what he's talking about, which is why you listen to the show. It's time well spent in the Savage Nation. And today, I think, is one of those days I can proudly say that is true. It's not true every day and every moment. It could never be so. But today, it's very good. And the reason it's very good is because I'm trying my best. To alert you to the biggest fraud in the history of this republic, and that nothing's happened after it. In other words, usually after a 9/11, the country was galvanized to understand that Islamofascism was threatening our way of life, and rightly so. In fact, a whole new department of the government was created, Homeland Security, to just show you what government did. It expanded government. That's what government does. It expands government. Now we've had a catastrophe that is equal to 9/11 in the sense that Osama bin Laden has said, struck the World Trade Center hoping to cripple our economy. Well, thank God he didn't succeed. But if nationalizing our banks and not forcing the crooks to give up some of their earnings does not cripple our economy, even more so than 9/11, I don't know what could. If an invading force had invaded America and said, we're going to impose a socialist system upon your economic system because we are socialists. And the first thing we're going to do is nationalize two of the largest mortgage lenders in the country. You'd say, well, we're at war. And you'd say, yeah, we're at war. And rightly so, we're not going to let a Chavez-like government take over America because we're not socialists. We're capitalists. We believe in the free market. At least you did 2 days ago. Or last week you heard about the free market. Many of you were being lectured about the free market from shills in the media who told you there were Republican conservatives. Well, where are they today? Why are they not lecturing you about the collapse of the free market under George Bush, the fiscal socialist? Why are they not telling you that he doubled our national debt over the weekend? Why are they not telling you why the Democrats who should jump on this are not saying a word? Why? The answer is simple. I then talked about a German, I think, lieutenant general in World War II in the Battle of Cassino. He was a man who hated Hitler. He hated National Socialism, but he was an aristocrat who was in the military, who did what he had to do as a general. And his name was Friedlin von Senger, commanding the 14th Panzer Corps. And here's the line that I want you to remember. Descended from an ancient family of lesser princes that lost its estates in the Napoleonic Wars and its wealth in the Weimar inflation. Sanger had studied at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar before finding his calling in the Great War. The operational phrases are lost its estates in the Napoleonic Wars and its wealth in the Weimar inflation. The Weimar Republic followed World War I in Germany. The Weimar Republic, in some ways, has mimicked the United States of America ever since Clinton hijacked the nation. Ever since Clinton hijacked America, we've had investment bankers as Treasury secretaries, one after the other. Wall Street bankers have run the Treasury. Now, there's nothing on the face of it that's inherently wrong with a Wall Street banker if he is inherently honest and puts his country before his cronies. I would argue that ever since Clinton seized power in this country, the opposite is true, that the bankers who've been running the Treasury have been running it as a personal fiefdom for the benefit of themselves and their own friends. I would then further argue that we are more like the Weimar Republic today than we were last week. And I would argue that the social disintegration of the United States of America today is far worse than anything the world saw in the Weimar Republic in Germany. If you remember movies like The Blue Angel, the cabaret singing and things of that nature, and the stories of what went on in Berlin, that is nothing compared to the degeneracy of the United States of America. This country is so morally bankrupt that it makes the Weimar Republic look like an Orthodox Christian time in German history, when it certainly wasn't. Now, what does it have to do with economics, and why am I telling you about this? Because the moral degeneracy of America today, the moral bankruptcy of America today, is very similar to the financial bankruptcy of America today. Because the people have been misled by pornography, because the people have been fed a steady diet of girls with lipstick and short skirts on television, which passes for the news, because the people's brains are addled with internet pornography and low-life, white trash sluts in Hollywood who are shown to us in every way and every day to the extent that a 9-year-old girl wants to be like them, all because of the insanity of the media barons who have taken over the mind of the American people. The moral bankruptcy of America has now been followed by the financial bankruptcy of America, and it is all interrelated. When a nation becomes morally bankrupt, a financial bankruptcy soon follows. Excess is followed by excess, and eventually those excesses are followed by bankruptcy. And I am telling you that the bankruptcy of America today may already have occurred, and I am not the only one who says it. We are living on a currency that is built on quicksand. Coming up next is something related to this. I spoke with Selwyn Duke, one of my favorite guests, about pornography and Bernie Ward, the radical left-wing anti-American talk show host who is now serving time in prison for having disseminated or shared pornographic images of children as young as 3 years of age in full sexual contact with adults. And we're going to talk about what pornography means with Selwyn Duke right here on the Savage Nation. I would hope that you will listen very soon. You all know the story of disgraced left-wing radical talk show host Bernie Ward and his prison sentence for distributing child pornography. What he did was absolutely wrong. I mean, the man distributed pictures of children as young as 3 years of age in full sexual contact with adults. And this brings up the question of regular pornography and the protection of the First Amendment and what should and shouldn't be covered by the First Amendment. Our next guest, Selwyn Duke, joins us today to talk about his thoughts on this. Selwyn Duke, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you again. Michael, I know you've discussed how left-wing talk show host Bernie Ward was sentenced to prison for the distribution of child pornography. Now, few have much compassion for this disgraced man, but still, maybe I ought to provide some information we won't hear from the mainstream media. After all, Ward's not a Republican or a conservative, you know. Now, some might think Ward was another Jerry Lee Lewis or Roman Polanski, but really, he was more like the Roman Emperor Tiberius, this guy descended into some truly dark perversion. For instance, Ward possessed images of sex acts on children as young as 3 years old. 3 years old. And Justice Department lawyer Steve Grocki tells us, quote, "These images depicted these minors suffering the most horrific torment Ward traded in the currency of human suffering," unquote. Now, I should point out that in these images, at least some of the children were being abused by full-grown men. But that's actually all I'm going to say about that, because even in these libertine times, virtually everyone agrees that such material is beyond the pale. And also, I want to talk about something else today. I want to give people some food for thought, because, okay, we all agree that child pornography is indefensible. We agree. But here's the question. Are some of our defenses of regular pornography also indefensible? Now, this is worth talking about, too, because pornography has completely saturated our society. I mean, it's big business. We have the Internet bringing it to hundreds of millions of households the world over. And we all know it's now even viewed by children. And look, many of these kids wouldn't otherwise even lay their hands on a girly magazine. And you know what? Even if they did, many of them would be afraid to bring it home. But now, they have a pornorama at the touch of a mouse. Now, we could talk about this. We could ask, for instance, is regular porn a gateway perversion? I mean, just like some label marijuana a gateway drug? We could also discuss how it encourages married men to lust after other women in their heart, to use a phrase Jesus used, and commit virtual land adultery.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people would say, yeah, but that's the price of freedom.
But here's the thing. Is it really the price of freedom? I mean, freedom properly understood. Okay, I know what some are thinking, but I'm not going to make a case for the criminalization of pornography right now. That's not what I'm going to do. That doesn't mean I don't have thoughts on the matter, mind you, but I'd rather discuss something else. Let's talk about one of the arguments used to advocate its legality. And that argument is that such expression is protected under our First Amendment. This is the indefensible position I mentioned earlier. Now, the problem here is that it isn't just modern-day Marquis de Sade who say this. No, let's face it. Many basically moral people believe it's a matter of holding freedom of speech sacrosanct. And the thinking is this. If we allow the censors to prevail in one area, even this one, what shoe will drop next? Whose speech will be in the crosshairs next? But, and here's the food for thought, what if I told you that this very attitude threatens legitimate freedom of speech? And here's what I'm talking about. When we lump the frivolous in with what matters, the result is what really matters loses credibility. And I'll illustrate this with something analogous. Many are upset about the tendency to label ambiguous sexual encounters as rape, right? We've all heard about this, I think. And this incorrect labeling is the work of people who, in just the same way some civil rights activists read racism into everything, are so blinded by their own prejudices that a mere allegation of rape constitutes evidence in their minds. Now, maybe it's obvious why some people are upset by this. They realize what the result might be. It might be that these lesser acts won't be demonized as much as real rape will be trivialized. Okay, now let's see how this relates to free speech. When the Founding Fathers recognized the right to free speech, what was their concern? They were concerned about the stifling of political, religious, and social opinion. It was meant to apply to the written and spoken word.
Well, right. I don't think these 18th century men intended to protect pornography as something like flag burning through free speech.
That's a good point. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying all the founders would have been opposed to burning flags under all circumstances. I think opinion probably varied. But what I am saying is this. This wasn't contemplated as a First Amendment protection. It wasn't. And pornography? I mean, come on. Let's get real. Any claim the founders even considered such a thing when conceptualizing freedom of speech is ridiculous. And I also think it's pretty safe to say that these 18th century men wouldn't have taken issue with criminalizing porn either. I think that's a no-brainer. Anyway, the problem, Michael, is this. starting quite a while ago, in typical end justifies the means fashion, the advocates of smut just had to argue for its legalization by conflating it with true speech. And I guess it's not surprising. I mean, what moral argument could they have put forth? So, look, their only recourse was legal, even if it was a stupid rationalization. But now let's talk about what the result of allowing this camel's nose in the First Amendment's tent is. The result is that speech has become expression, and the right has been expanded to perverse proportions. I mean, think about it. It now covers not only porn and flag burning, but also the political and social activism and clothing of minors in schools.
That's just absurd.
I'll put it in perspective this way. Just as the category of heroes now includes the not-so-heroic, and I mean people like sports figures, the category of freedom of speech now includes the not-so-important. And I ask you, does this increase respect for the right, huh? Or does it diminish it? Think about that. And here's another analogy to put it in further perspective. It's like if we claim the Second Amendment protects the right to possess weapons of mass destruction. Think about what would happen if this became an assumption. Think about it. Well, people might just conclude that the right to bear arms wasn't such a good idea after all, right? Oh, and by the way, if anyone thinks this is a bad analogy, well, I'm sorry, but equating a nuclear device with arms occupies the same neighborhood of nonsense as equating a pornographic image with speech. They're both ridiculous.
Exactly.
So what's the point we have to emphasize here? Well, if you ever have to debate this issue, just understand that the Constitution is silent on pornography's legal status. This means, look, you can argue for its legality if you want to, without doing violence to the Constitution. That is, until and unless you do so based on a constitutional argument. Okay? Anyway, I'll leave you with this thought. Many today want to advocate hate speech laws like they have in other parts of the West. Well, listen, if we are ever muzzled with them, it'll be an abomination. It'll be an example of a lack of respect for the First Amendment. And if this does ever come to pass, we just may start to ponder how an earlier lack of respect for freedom of speech, one that offered its protections to an earlier abomination, helped corrupt a most cherished right.
Selwyn Duke, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Michael, thank you for having me on the show, and God bless you and your audience.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation, so we're talking about freedom. We're talking about how freedom is distorted and perverted. And we're talking about how the freedom of our republic has been distorted and perverted by the Wall Street gang, who has fundamentally socialized or nationalized the mortgage banks, Fannie and Freddie. I'm going to give away three free hardcover copies of my new autobiography, Psychological Nudity, between now and the end of this hour to three callers. And the phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. If you want to talk about the banking crisis, if you want to talk about the fact that childhood friends say Obama prayed at a mosque, according to the LA Times, or if you want to talk about any of the other stories on michaelsavage.com, which are worth talking about, let me see which other ones may be of interest to you. Here, WMD report, U.S. remains dangerously vulnerable. Here we go again. The U.S. is vulnerable to chemical, biological, and nuclear attacks 7 years after 9/11. A forthcoming independent study concludes. Here we go again. Just in time for the election, there go the red lights and the yellow lights. Just in time. House Democrats report says the Bush administration has repeatedly missed opportunities. Here we go. The Dems are saying the Republicans have missed opportunity. Republicans are saying the Dems have missed opportunity. And the recent rupture between Russia and the U.S. only makes matter worse, says former Rep. Lee Hamilton, D. Indiana, who helped lead the 9/11 Commission. Now, as you well know, the 9/11 Commission was a whitewash and a complete fraud. But they're apparently so happy with the work that they didn't do that they've spent millions of dollars since that whitewash to create another whitewash and blame the other party for the whitewash. The group includes leaders of the disbanded 9/11 Commission. I don't know who gave them the money, but apparently they're living very well on it. And they're blaming George Bush, saying the administration has failed to act in so many ways. This is Democrats now. These are the same Democrats who were soft on terrorism. These are the Democrats who said you can't torture Al-Qaeda members. These are the Democrats who said that members of the enemy who would cut your throat and throw your children down a well, should have the same protections as you do. These are the same people saying that George Bush and the Republicans have failed us. So what can I say? Do you want to join that discussion? Because it's a Democrat report. The same Democrats also blasted Bush policy in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia as damaging to national security. So what would they do? If Obama wins, what would George – what if Obama wins, God forbid, how would they combat terrorists in Pakistan? If Obama won, how would they fight the dictator of Iran? If Obama won, what do these fraudulent Democrats with this whitewash report have to say they would do to protect us better than the Republicans have? Please. I do not think that we should suspect that if Obama wins, he would say my Muslim brothers won't attack us if I get elected. Because, as you well know, the radical Islamists hate moderate Muslims more than they hate the other infidels. Just ask moderate Muslims how they're treated by the radicals in Algeria or in Morocco. Here's another story. World wants Obama as president. New York Post reports that Obama may be struggling to nudge ahead at his Republican rival in polls at home, but people across the world want him in the White House. No kidding. That's very nice to hear. I really care what they think in China or Africa about my election. What are the origins of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae? It's on michaelsavage.com. Great article. No one read it. The best article up there today is on the bottom, Globalist Ultimatum, Pay Up or Collapse. And it's about the debacle of the financial institutions that have wrecked the economy and are now sucking unlimited amounts of money from the people's treasury to bail themselves out. That's what I've been talking about. Okay? Tom, San Francisco, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mike. Yeah, big fan. Hey, I just want to let you know, it seems to me that if we did not bail, and I completely agree with you on this, but it seems that things would be a lot worse if they did not bail out Freddie and Fannie, as far as just the whole real estate in general, the economy. You know, something had to happen. And not that, you know, that was the right.
Yeah, but that's exactly the premise of the article, that the globalist ultimatum is pay up or collapse. They're saying to us that you have to pay for it, I have to pay for it, or the entire system collapses. There are financial experts who argue that that's utter rubbish. It's chicanery.
Yeah, but, well, so you're saying go ahead and let it collapse potentially, but it wouldn't necessarily collapse.
Wait a minute. Why are experts like Rogers Holding, Jim Rogers, saying you can see that this is welfare for the rich? This is socialism for the rich. It's bailing out the financiers, the banks, the Wall Streeters. That's what he's saying. They're not bailing you out. They're not bailing out the homeowner. They're not giving homeowners their houses back. The global financial crisis is fundamentally hitting all of us, and this is an attempt to make sure that those on Wall Street don't get hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, I know PIMCO, the guys from PIMCO came out and just with big old smiles thinking this is great because now their investment is financially secure through the government.
Correct. Their investment is secure. But are the people who have been thrown out of their houses going to benefit from this a bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? No. According to the August review, it says the major investment commercial banks who have wrecked our economy and financial system are now successfully sucking unlimited amounts of money from the people's treasury to bail themselves out.
Wow.
That's what I'm getting at. I wouldn't buy the line that it's pay up or the system collapses. I would say take back the money from the thieves who stole it from us. I mean, they have property. They have bank accounts all across the world and in Switzerland. They own buildings from here to Dubai. Hold a hearing, find out those who are responsible and seize their assets, and then let's see how much money is really missing. The money went somewhere. Remember that, my friend. The money went somewhere. It's invested somewhere. We could take it back from these thieves.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. And I'm demanding a congressional hearing. But I'm afraid that it would be run by Dianne Feinstein, who whitewashed so many commissions. She was the famous whitewasher of the killing of Randy Weaver's wife and son by ATF and FBI agents, if you remember correctly. And that was one of the low points of my life in radio, was when I watched Dianne Feinstein and I saw how dangerous a woman she is, conducting those hearings of the killing of Randy Weaver's wife and 14-year-old son by FBI and ATF marksmen. I watched Dianne Feinstein, the Queen of Diamonds, cold-heartedly sit there during those hearings and say quietly and slowly in a cadence that struck me as bizarre, "So tell us, officer, when you were about to take that shot, did the gingham curtain wave across Randy Weaver's wife's face and cause you to miss him and hit her while she was holding the infant in her arms, officer?" That was Dianne Feinstein, the great senator from Northern California. I watched that hearing. I've watched many hearings, and I know they're all whitewashes. The only hearing that would be worthwhile would be a people's hearing, a true people's hearing of the bailout of Fannie and Freddie, a people's hearing that would demand to see the financial records of the directors of these organizations before they joined, while they were there, and after they left. How much did they profit from the meltdown of these two financial giants? This is socialism for the rich. I agree 100%. But you say, well, now you're sounding like a socialist yourself. I'm not a socialist. I believe in capitalism. I believe in the free market. Are you telling me the government takeover of Fannie and Freddie is the free market working? If so, then you're a perfect candidate to listen to the golfer. Because the fact of the matter is, this is socialism by any means. I still haven't given away a copy of Psychological Nudity this hour, and I want to do that to the next caller. Johnny in Medford, Oregon, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Michael. My point is, the bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is the golden parachute for Wall Street.
That's correct. And why was there no congressional vote on this? How could Bush just do it over the weekend? Who gave him that authority?
It's all interlocking corporate directorships.
All right, Johnny, all I can do is give you a free copy of a book. What's the name of the book? And you'll get it if you know the title.
Psychological Nudity.
You stay on the line and you're going to get a free copy the day it's printed, and the printer is going to print it. And we'll send you a Psychological Nudity. It should be to your door by November 1st. And that's why I'm imploring my listeners who want this book for the holidays to buy it now over the next week or two, because I frankly don't know if I'm going to reprint it. And if I sell it out, it's not going to be in time for the holidays in plain English. New York City, WOR. David, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, how are you?
Good.
Anyway, I was doing some work this past summer in New Mexico, and I came across an old man, and we got to talking. Anyway, this is what the story he told me, and I want to share it with you. He tells me, when I was a young man, there was a young politician who came with new ideas and with new trends. Nobody knew him, but he was an amazing orator, and he knew how to captivate and hold the crowd. He promised reform, economical reform, to shape everything up in the country from top to bottom, but he had no record to prove that he can accomplish what he was promising. This new politician's name was Adolf Hitler.
That's right. I agree with you. Watch out.
He said he would
change things, but he didn't tell us how he would change things, did he?
That's right. Now, if record shows that all you have is known connections to radical preachers and terrorists, and your main skill is being an amazing orator, then I'm afraid this next country might elect another Adolf Hitler.
Well, I wouldn't say Obama could be the next Adolf Hitler. I would say he could be the next, the first dictator of the United States of America. I wouldn't say on the order of Hitler. I would say it would be a more benign kind of dictatorship. Something much softer than National Socialism, something as opposed to, let's say, re-education camps that you saw in the Soviet Union. It would be on the order of forced re-education in corporations and in schools, which, of course, is going on right now, as you well know. We're already 50% towards a dictatorship. You're telling me that diversity training isn't a dictatorship? Forcing a person in a corporate setting who doesn't want to be there to listen to rubbish and lies from people who are teaching you to accept ways of life that you know to be perverse and anti-God? That's not diversity training. Diversity training is not already a dictatorship.
That's right.
Thank you. All right. But don't get me started on that. 1-800-449-8255, phone number. MichaelSavage.com is the website. I still have two copies of Psychological Nudity to give out before the end of the hour. Let's go to another caller somewhere in America. There's somebody. Oh, here we go. Portland. Chris, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. I just wanted, I completely, what I wanted to talk to you about wasn't important. I think this deal with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is such a crock when the Senate and the House were up in arms about the bailing out the homeowners, and yet they'll give Bear Stearns however many billion and they'll give money out to Yin Yang to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Why is that?
Well, I've been discussing it to the point that I don't want to repeat it. That's all. It didn't make any sense. They didn't bail out Bear Stearns. This is all about one investment bank on Wall Street trying to destroy all of the others on Wall Street and wind up the only one that survives. This is all about predatory capitalism. This is all about evil personified, and it's going on right before your eyes. This is the greatest theft in American history. What you are watching is the greatest theft in American history. In fact, the destruction of Bear Stearns by the other gangsters on Wall Street was considered at the time the greatest theft in American history, but it palls by comparison to the bailout of Freddie and Fannie, which is now on a magnitude unimaginable even at that time. And yet, neither Obama nor McCain has addressed this issue in an intelligent manner. Neither candidate has said, this theft that we are witnessing, this nationalization of these mortgage giants, this nationalization is antithetical to our American free market system. It is also chicanery and thievery. And when I become president, the first thing I will do after inauguration is conduct an investigation through the FBI, and we will find out if there was any cooking of the books. We'll find out who benefited from this. And if there is any chicanery, we will punish them to the full extent of the law, including seizing their assets and any assets they may have transferred to their families, either in America or abroad. Whoever would say that, I would vote for. But you haven't heard that from Obama, the alleged Robin Hood. Why haven't you heard that from Obama? The answer is because the lobbyists have paid off the Democrats as well as the Republicans to go mum and dummy up on this issue. I've said all I'm going to say on this week. I'm not going to say another word. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I want to close this hour out by talking about the hypocrisy of the feminists of the United States of America. I was speaking with a woman today, and she said to me, Michael, what do you think about the feminists who are arguing that Sarah Palin cannot be both the vice president and the mother of five children? She said, what do you think of that? I said, where'd you hear that? She said, oh, liberal commentators on NPR are suddenly mouthing off against Sarah Palin, saying, gee, she can't be the mother of five children and the vice president. I said, sounds like hypocrisy to me. I said, I thought feminists said women could do it all. They could have family and a career. Well, I guess that applies only to liberals who want to work in pornography and have a family. Or a liberal who wants to be a community activist and have a family. I guess that works. But if you're a conservative like Sarah Palin, I guess it doesn't apply. Well, that's sheer rubbish. It shows you what hypocrites liberals are. In fact, CNN anchor has fallen to a new level. This guy, John Roberts, whoever he is. He went down to this level of attacking Sarah Palin on this level. John Roberts on CNN said, children with Down syndrome require an awful lot of attention. The role of a vice president, seems to me, would take up an awful lot of her time, and it raises the issue of how much time will she have to dedicate to her newborn child, close quote. That's from CNN anchor John Roberts asking during a live segment on August 29th, the day McCain announced Palin's candidacy. Now you got Sally Quinn, a far-left radical out-of-touch columnist with the so-called Washington Post, another newspaper that's dying, who wrote in a recent online column that Palin's need to care for a special needs son, Trigg, and her daughter, Bristol, not to mention her other three children, quote, inevitably an enormous distraction for a new vice president in a time of global turmoil. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. Here we've got fraudulent old hags who declare themselves to be feminists, shrieking like witches that a woman cannot be both a mother to children, even a sick child, and a politician, a successful politician. How come that didn't apply to Hillary Clinton when she was running for the presidency? I mean, she had a child, of course. It was a grown child. But at one point, she was the co-president, and she had a child who was actually a real child. Did anyone say that she shouldn't be married to Bill Clinton and be so activist? I didn't hear it then. So now they're arguing the opposite. The questioning of Palin's priorities is clearly, in my opinion, sexist. But the sexism is coming not from conservatives, but from phony, hysterical, shrill feminists. What do you think about that? What do you think about this? Does that make any sense to you? So they're claiming that she can't do both? I never heard of anything like this. But this shows you again that liberalism is not only a mental disorder, it is a hypocritical mental disorder. I don't think that this is a debate that we should even be having. This is astonishing to me. For the media to be covering it in this manner is sexism beyond comprehension, but it's all coming from liberals. She has a young infant who needs her mother. So what? I mean, she was a governor. She was able to handle her dual role as a mother and vice president and as a mother and as a governor. She's done it already. This is unbelievable to me. But again, the hypocrisy is coming from the feminists who are all liberals. It's not coming from conservatives. The fact of the matter is conservatives are not questioning whether she could be both a mother and a vice president. The only people questioning Palin's candidacy are the radical feminists. Shrill, nightmarish girls I've been telling you about for 15 years on the radio show. Big Sis is a miss. Never forget that. And Big Sis has never been a feminist. Big Sis has always been quasi-fascist. And they will turn any argument in any way that they want, even if it shows them to be the utter fraudulent witches and hypocrites that they really are. So that's it for today. We talked about various hypocrisies from Wall Street to the feminist movement. And I hope that you've learned something and I hope you've enjoyed it. If not, I've done the best I can. All I can do is bait my hook with my heart every day and hope you will bite. And by the way, psychological nudity is 75 stories from the heart. Go to michaelsavage.com and check it out.
Savage.